did you do it?
I didn't put my name in that cup. I don't want eternal glory.
It's Mad-Eye Moody.
Avada Kedavra. The killing curse. Only one person is known to have survived it. He's sitting in this room.
People die in this tournament. The devils are inside the walls.
Something's coming closer. I can feel it.
The Dark Lord shall rise again.
Is it Voldemort?
Isn't it?
Just a bit of the trailer from the new Harry Potter movie that opened over the weekend to much rave review. We're going to be talking about it for the next 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back for the second hour of the program, coming to you live this Monday, the 21st of November. Pastor Todd Peppercorn joins us for this 25 minutes. He's pastor of Messiah Lutheran Church in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and executive editor of Higher Things magazine. It's a youth magazine, and he saw the Harry Potter movie. Then in about 25 minutes, Dr. Patty Nason will join us to talk about this recent Charles Krauthammer column on evolution and intelligent design. Krauthammer, I just feel so disappointed in this guy, but he says intelligent design is a farce, has nothing to do with science. Uwe Simonetta will join us a little later in the program to begin a series on lay vocation. We'll talk about his vocation to begin with. Can a Christian be a journalist? He'll answer that question up front. Coming up a little later on the program, Pastor Todd Peppercorn is a regular guest. Todd, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
All right, you saw the movie. I've been reading the reviews. I have not seen it. Is it as good as everyone says it is?
Well, in my estimation, I think I'd say it's probably the best out of the four we've seen so far. It's fun. I really enjoyed it. No doubt about it.
What makes it the best, in your opinion?
The challenge that the Potter movies have faced in part is kind of building up this elaborate wizardry scenery of Hogwarts Castle. And so the previous three movies, I felt, spent a lot of time kind of just painting the picture. And while painting the picture was interesting, it didn't really move the plot along. This one, I did not spend nearly as much time doing that, and so they worked harder to work on plot development and conflict between the characters. I think it had a little bit better elements of a good story and not a nice painting.
I remember when this particular novel came out. Now, this was some years ago. It takes a little time for these things to come to the screen. But I was talking with a fellow pastor who was reading through these books with his kids. And he had already read this novel, the one that the latest film is based on. And he said, well, this one's darker. And he says, and somebody dies in this one.
Right. It actually, from my perspective, it's the darkness of this movie that also makes it better, but that makes it less appropriate for smaller children. So better for adults, maybe, but not so good for, I would say, under 10. I would certainly say under 10, maybe even more like 11 or 12.
So Harry and his friends are now teenagers.
That's right.
What element does that role play, that whole, you know, subplot of what it means to be an adolescent play in this Harry Potter movie?
Well, what you've had in the previous three movies is that they were basically junior high school students in this school for wizardry. And at this point, they're portrayed as freshmen, sophomores in high school, let's say. What that means in this movie is that there's a little bit more emphasis played on kind of adolescent sexual tension. There's a little more emphasis played on boy-girl stuff. There's some dating. One of the big scenes in the movie is this grand ball that they go on. And while that isn't prominent like it was in the most recent book, for example, it's certainly there, and it means that you're getting a little bit older themes that are coming out in the book. That's how I'd put it.
As a pastor, do you feel the need to stay abreast of these kind of things? To read the books, to
sure.
see the films.
Well, I do. I have read all the books, and I do see the movies, partly, frankly, because I just like them. I think that they're good. They're good stories. They raise interesting questions. I think pastors have an obligation, to a certain extent, to be aware of what's going on in the culture around them. Obviously, not partaking of everything, especially things that are sinful. But pastors that kind of are blissfully ignorant of these things, especially something like this, where they're grossing over $100 million for the first weekend. So this is, chances are, my congregation, I don't know, 30% of my parishioners probably saw it this weekend. So I would be a fool not to make some effort to kind of keep an eye on what's going on. And then to be able to use that as an opportunity, especially in Bible classes, for example, to talk about some themes going on in the movies and how Christians can understand them. It's a great opportunity, and I think we would be foolish not to see it that way.
Let's talk about some of those themes. What would you pull out of the story up to this point, as far as it's made it, you know, into the books? I think we're now talking about when the author comes out with her seventh book. I think that's the planned end of the whole Harry Potter thing. They spend 7 years at Hogwarts, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
What have you found so far in the books, and then in particular in this film, by way of themes that are useful to Christian adults, Christian young people?
Well, first of all, what both the books and the movies do is they try and portray in kind of a caricature fashion the life of a typical young person, and that is good. And sometimes when you can see things on film or in books, it can give you an opportunity to look at things like peer pressure, friendship, love and romance, some of the things that, and maybe even more so, the question of identity. Those are some themes that are very significant for young people to understand. And so in those respects, we can look at things like that and use them. Although this fourth movie, going along with the fourth book, starts to, maybe even more than the previous three, starts to have a clearer sense of good and evil. And that's while the book was certainly where the series kind of took a very dark turn. I actually appreciated that more as a Christian pastor, because the good and evil is much clearer in this book than it is in the previous ones. There's a definite sense of right and wrong, and of the consequences and what's going to happen, and that people even die. That not everything is kind of roses and cute. So that sense of sacrifice, that sense of truth, that sense of a reality of darkness and evil is healthy. That's good. Christians should recognize that.
The one thing, picking up on that, Pastor Peppercorn, that I noticed in this, the fourth, having not seen the film but read the book, is that evil is portrayed as, it's not cartoon evil. It is not ooh, that's a scary thing that just, you know, flew past us kind of evil. This is real evil.
That's exactly, and that's where this book, and that I would suggest is where this movie has a sense of, has a real strength to it, is you almost get a sense that, you know, this was almost play up until this point, but this is the first one where one of Harry's friends dies. This is not a game. This is very real, and that I think is a helpful thing. It's a real helpful thing for the books, because it does demonstrate that there are consequences. That this is a real battle. That this is not just not just sort of cartoon fun.
In the first several books and the first several movies, adults and parents played very small roles initially, and if they did play any role, they were kind of buffoons or kind of just rotten people. And then, it seems, especially in this fourth one, adults and even parents, and the parent figures like the teachers, suddenly become allies. They become necessary, not just people who are trying to catch Harry and his friends at what they're doing, but now they're necessary allies in their fight against evil.
That's right. And that I think is one of the other key elements that you don't see in this movie. The previous three movies always have this little bit of an undercurrent of making fun of muggles, of people, particularly adults that don't have magical powers. And there's always this sense with all of the adults, but especially with parents, that, well, you know, we sort of tolerate them, but they're basically boorish, and we're not going to have much to do with them. Muggles don't play any role at all in this movie, so you don't have that kind of tension. Or, again, looking at it from a Christian perspective, you don't have nearly the fourth commandment concern and issue that this movie is going to teach my children that disobeying professors is okay as long as they're bad professors. I didn't see much of that sense at all. And in fact, probably certainly you have Dumbledore as kind of this grandfather figure that's very increasingly significant, starting with this one. They play a very positive role. And now one of the other odd things about this movie is that there wasn't much of a sense of the children, of any of Harry's cohorts as really being evil. His kind of nemesis in the first three ones was this Draco Malfoy, this classmate of his. And Malfoy only has one little scene in this where he's just kind of a bully, and it's just not that, it's not that big of a scene. The real evil is coming from the adults now, not fellow kids. So again, I think that's moving it in a slightly different direction, which is probably helpful from my perspective.
As the novels progress, in the beginning of the novels, there is this evil, but it's kind of a shadow out there. And it has it can cause trouble, but it's largely kind of mischief type of things. Then in the second one, there's a even kind of a physical form. And in this one, there is the sense that the forces of evil are in fact there. They're not going away. Harry's going to have to deal with them sooner or later.
Right. Well, and in this movie, the forces of evil become incarnate, that literally become enfleshed, that this is not just something that can be kind of dealt with later. And that's one of the things that is that I think is interesting too about these movies, is that they can have a sense of teaching that that temptation and evil is just as real for the young person as it is for an adult. And we certainly live in a culture and in a time when young people can be thrust into situations and circumstances that from our perspective they shouldn't be in. They shouldn't have to make these kind of decisions. They shouldn't have to make these sort of choices. And so it is kind of an interesting thing to watch and see. Harry really is being forced to become an adult, maybe faster than he wants to, but there's this sense that, you know, some things are not going to be put off. I can't pretend to be something else. I can't pretend to be a child any longer.
See, that's I think kind of the theme. If you could, I mean, look at it from a perspective and laying aside all the magic, this is the realization that, you know, it's time to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the hardest thing to learn.
Mm-hmm.
When you're going through adolescence and young adulthood. Now it's time to grow up.
Well, and also there's a sense that it's not all about you. That growing up means serving your neighbor, even if it's not something that you like to do or want to do. So there's this scene in this near the end of the movie, for example, when Potter and his classmate / fellow competitor Diggory are racing toward this goblet, and Diggory falls, and Potter has to make this choice. Well, am I going to save him or am I going to win? Well, I mean, I suppose it's a slightly corny caricature, but it is a significant one. Sometimes you don't get what you want. Sometimes serving your neighbor simply means doing what is right, and the consequences will happen as they happen.
We're talking about the new Harry Potter movie. Pastor Todd Peppercorn is our guest. He's pastor of Messiah Lutheran Church in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and executive editor of a youth magazine called Higher Things. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We are coming to you live this Monday. It's the 21st of November. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Bill, who calls from his car. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, I've watched some snippets of a Harry Potter movie. I didn't follow through with it, and I really haven't read any of the books, so I can't really critique it. But what does disturb me is that Harry Potter's involved in sorcery. The Bible expressly prohibits dabbling or getting involved in sorcery. So my question is, why even try to extract any redeeming benefits from this? It's sorcery. God doesn't like it.
Bill, thank you. It's a good question. In fact, that was my next question for you. How do we deal with the whole issue of magic, which is an integral part of the whole plot, of the setting, of the characters?
Well, I think that I would probably back it up just a little bit more before we talk about that, and I think that's a good question. We need to address it head on. And that's the question of fantasy or of fiction in general. Christians for thousands of years, I would say certainly a millennium, have utilized fiction and even fantasy all the way back to the King Arthur legends, which by the way included magic of some sort or another with Merlin and everything. That they've used these to, particularly to teach virtue, to teach moral behavior, kind of second table of the law sort of things. That Christians have embraced this for a very, very long time. And one of the things that I think we need to wrestle with as Christians living in the world today is, can Christians utilize fiction? And we could understand fiction as saying, okay, fiction is a lie. God doesn't like lying, therefore any fiction is evil. Well, now obviously we know that that's not the case, because our Lord himself used parables repeatedly. He used stories that he would tell in order to teach the faith. So we can understand that there is a way where you can use fiction in recognizing this is not real. I think that's a first step that we need to understand. Secondly, when it comes to magic and sorcery, obviously our listener is correct. The second commandment very expressly forbids sorcery of any sort, consulting the dead and so on. I would suggest I don't really think that that's the point of the Harry Potter movies. I mean, this is more like this is a scene that is being used, and that if we want to kind of get at these deeper issues of what is the intent behind the author, the intent behind the author in these books is not to teach children how to use witchcraft. I just don't buy it. It's not there. We could argue about what some of the other intents are, which we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes. But the intent behind it is not that. Now, if we were talking about another series like the Pullman series, that's expressly intended in order to deny God and kind of bring the rise of atheism, then I think we'd be dealing with something else. But if we're going to toss out and say any kind of fiction that has anything to do in it that's untrue, then we've basically tossed out the entire concept of fiction.
One of the things that strikes me about the whole use of magic in the books, two things. First of all, if this were a book about, or for that matter, a movie about partners in crime or something like that, we can certainly say, well, God does not approve of crime, stealing, burglary, all these kinds of things.
Right.
And yet the stories can be told in such a way, people doing bad things to a good, not that they do bad things to a good end, but the stories can be told to a good end.
Right.
God certainly doesn't approve of what they're doing in this piece of fiction, but we tell the stories to a different end than to encourage wrongdoing. The other thing about it, and I wonder if you agree, Pastor Peppercorn, is that the magic in these Harry Potter movies, especially as the movies go on, is more and more a two-edged sword.
Right.
It is more and more something that is used with great caution rather than just kind of, hey, I know how to do magic, so I do it.
Right. And that's one of the things that, that Potter kind of develops, is recognizing that there is a sense of good and evil to this. This last great conflict scene when Voldemort comes back to life. Well, in that scene, there is very much a sense of magic as an evil thing. Now, I don't know. It would be interesting to explore contrasting kind of good magic versus bad magic. It usually isn't portrayed that way, really, but it's there, I guess. I just don't think that's not what's driving these books and these movies. Is the magic issue that what's driving them is good versus evil?
Dr. Gene Edward Veith has made the argument on this program that in the Harry Potter movies, in the Narnia Chronicles, in the Tolkien trilogy,
mm-hmm.
magic is akin to what we would call technology.
Sure. I think it's certainly in the Potter movies, it's usually portrayed as morally neutral. Occasionally, you'll get a scene of something that is very specifically evil, but these are basically tools. I mean, you could almost have the same kind of movie done at a cowboy school as a wizarding school. You could have the same plot. You could have, you know, very much of the exact same kind of thing could be done. The magic is not integral to the plot.
Finally, dealing with youth as you do, Pastor Peppercorn, how do you think kind of the typical jaded, I've gone to a million movies and seen every one of them, teenager is going to receive the latest Harry Potter movie with 30 seconds to respond?
I think that they're probably going to like it, especially the high school student, because the high school student is not going to be all that impressed with the cutesiness and stuff of the first couple movies. Because this movie takes on a more serious tone and a much darker tone, the high school student is probably going to look at that and say, "Hey, this is something. This is a big deal. This kid is getting a chance to be involved in something really important." And so my guess is that the high school student's probably going to look at this and is really going to enjoy it.
Pastor Todd Peppercorn is pastor of Messiah Lutheran Church in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He's executive editor of Higher Things magazine. By the way, this is a great Christmas gift idea for your high school or college-age child or grandchild. Send them a subscription to Higher Things magazine. For more information, go to their website, higherthings.org. It's all one word, higherthings.org. Pastor Peppercorn, thanks for being our guest.
My pleasure.
When we come back from this break, we've got, we're halfway through the program today, and we've got Dr. Patty Nason on the line to talk about, well, I'll say it again, I'm somewhat disappointed. You read Charles Krauthammer with a fair degree of agreement on most issues, but not this time. He wrote under Science and Religion a recent column, Fraud in Kansas, Sense in Pennsylvania, where he's taking intelligent design to task, and he says it's something akin to warmed-over creationism. He says it as science, it is a fraud. We'll have Dr. Patty Nason respond to that right after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Larry Rast, Arthur Just, Carl Fekincher, Kurt Marquardt, Peter Scare, Cameron McKenzie.
You probably recognize these names as regular guests on Issues, Etc. But what else do they have in common? Well, they're all members of the Christ-centered, cross-focused faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Dean Wenthe, Walter A. Meyer II, David Scare, Dan Gard, Charles Geeshan, Bill Weinrich.
Have you ever considered the pastoral ministry? Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call them 1-800-481-2155. Preparing Christ-centered, cross-focused pastors for the 21st century. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
John Pless, Hal Senkbeil, Richard Muller, Roland Ziegler.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. Last month, it appeared that legislation to fund stem cell research that would use umbilical cord blood was going to get a Senate vote in January. Now the bill is being held hostage indefinitely by those who want another bill passed that will have taxpayers funding the very controversial embryonic stem cell process. Bill Wilson reports.
Even the small chance that the life-saving cord blood stem cell legislation would be passed this month has been dashed by what Kansas Senator Sam Brownback says is a hypocritical move by Senate Democrats.
And they are saying, while I don't oppose it, I will not let it come up unless you'll bring up expansion of embryonic stem cell research. And so it's being held in these secret holds by some members on the other side of the aisle.
And Brownback is angered by the politics of the situation.
I think it's wrong for people to hold that up when we've got cures and people being treated now with this cord blood. And we need to expand the cord blood banking in this country and its accessibility and cures and treatments that can come out of cord blood.
Arizona Congressman Trent Franks says the House sent the non-controversial bill to the Senate with some urgency so that lives might be saved now.
They're so committed to embryonic stem cell research, which takes the lives of an embryo, that they're willing to kill or delay a bill that everyone can agree on that does not require the death of an embryo. And I think that's just an unconscionable thing.
The cord blood bill has virtually no opposition, passing in the House 431-1. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bill Wilson in Washington.
Basketball's legendary Dr. J has been pushing senators to move quickly on the cord blood legislation. You can call your senators, too, and urge an immediate vote on S-1317. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Treasures from the Royal Tombs of Ur brings to the St. Louis Art Museum the discoveries of one of the greatest archaeological finds of all time. This exhibition of rare Sumerian works of art date back nearly 5,000 years and include intricate and breathtakingly beautiful jewelry, mosaics, and ceremonial objects. Precious metals and stones are combined in some of the earliest masterpieces of decorative arts from the dawn of Western civilization. Treasures from the Royal Tombs of Ur, now at the St. Louis Art Museum.
If you've ever wondered about the issues that were the basis for agreement and disagreement during the Reformation, we have a book for you. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November is titled Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, a reader's edition of the Book of Concord. You can find out more by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 or look for the cover of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions on our website, issuesetc.org.
Big event coming up in January at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. It's their annual theological symposium, exegetical and confessional theology. A symposium is just kind of a meeting together of various ideas. This is an amazing event, very well attended, which means if you're interested in going to the theological symposium at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, you will want to find out your information early. It's coming up January the 17th through the 20th in 2006. That's not that far away, on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, you can go to their website, ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or give them a call at area code 260-452-2247. Ask about the Theological Symposium at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 260-452-2247. There are two parts to this symposium. The first one is justification in the Scriptures. They're going to be dealing with the challenges, both old and new, to this doctrine upon which the church stands or falls. And they'll also be talking about the Holy Spirit as the giver, gift, and gifts at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, January the 17th through the 20th of next year. Dr. Patty Nason is our guest. We're going to be talking for the next 10 minutes or so about a recent Charles Krauthammer column on evolution and intelligent design. This column, I usually read Krauthammer with some bit of glee and agreement. But this one's titled Fraud in Kansas, Sense in Pennsylvania, and he is arguing, among other things, that intelligent design in terms of science is a fraud. Dr. Patty Nason is chairman of the Department of Science Education for the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Nason, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, nice to be there.
First of all, your general reaction to one of the things that Charles Krauthammer says in this piece, and that is that intelligent design is warmed over creationism as science.
There's several things I believe about this article. He does not understand what science really is, and he doesn't understand our God. And for it to be warmed over creation, I really don't understand why he put that fluffy derogatory word with creation, because those intelligent design scientists have some scientific proof. They cannot find evidence against it like we can find evidence against evolution.
The assumption seems to be that evolution is science. He didn't even seem to deal with that, but that intelligent design should be viewed with a great deal of skepticism because it doesn't qualify as science in any sense. He says it does not fail to meet the basic basic prerequisite for something scientific as a theory in that it cannot be disproven. How do you respond?
Well, first of all, evolution can't be proven, and it has been disproven, and intelligent design is the same way. Actually, when you get down to the nuts and bolts of it, origins is a philosophical question, not a scientific question. I can see that he doesn't understand the difference between macroevolution and macroevolution, because he points to some something about us always, or the intelligent design folks, or the creationists always pointing to evolutionary changes within species. Well, of course, we believe in that, but we don't believe it on a large scale.
Okay, so would you explain that distinction to us, just to make clear the point you're making there, the difference between microevolution, which you know, most creationists and intelligent designers say, yeah, that's obvious, and macroevolution.
Okay, microevolution merely means that there are changes within a species, within a kind, just like God said, go and create after kind. The original dog could have had so much variation in it that we see all the dogs, including wolves, which can interbreed with dogs, that we see today. Whereas the evolutionists would believe that they start out with this DNA, and it changed over time and added more DNA and added more and more and became all the critters that we see today, all the species that we see today.
So macroevolution is variation on a theme. There are themes, but within those themes, there are variations. Big dogs, little dogs, same thing with people, same thing with any species there might be.
That's micro, yes.
Microevolution. Macroevolution says, no, you can change from theme to theme, and it does happen, and it must happen.
Yes, and they have no evidence of this. They've never seen it. We've never seen it happen, never seen it done. They are creating new animals, but that's with manipulation, and oftentimes those animals can't reproduce. They manipulate but deny that God did any of this planning ahead of time.
Okay, one other thing that Krauthammer says here, and I'd like your reaction to it. He says that intelligent design is a self-enclosed tautological theory whose only holding is that when there are gaps in some area of scientific knowledge, in this case evolution, they are to be filled with God. Is that a fair representation of what intelligent design is trying to do?
No. Intelligent design, the folks that said this, aha, this could not have just happened accidentally. It could not have happened over time. And it couldn't happen over a long period of time. There are too many things that would have had to change at the same time in order for macroevolution to take place. There is just no way that an organism would have survived, because there would have been too many mechanisms that would have had to change at the very same time. And there's statistically, there's no way. We would have to add billions and billions and billions of years onto the time scale that we have. And even then, it probably would be impossible. So he's saying something that's really, he's trying to cover evolutionist ideas, because they are saying that just because they can't explain something, we're trying to fill it in with God. No, we're trying to fill the whole thing in with God, not just those gaps. but the whole idea of why we are here.
He also says that intelligent design will ultimately bring religion itself into ridicule, and he seems to want to argue that would be a bad thing to bring religion into ridicule, and I'll take him at his word there. He doesn't want to see religion ridiculed, and intelligent design will end up there. Is he right?
Oh, well, religion is already being ridiculed, especially Christianity. The bottom line is here we live in the land of the free and the home of the brave, but we're supposed to be standing for freedom, academic freedom, to be able to problem solve, to be able to question things, and yet anybody that questions evolution, which is equated with science, there's always some excuse for that questioning. You can go to other countries that used to be in the Iron Curtain, and they are free to teach different theories of origins, but we're not in this country. Like I say, our very academic freedom and the freedom of speech are what's at the bottom line. And basically, evolution is a religion because it supports several different religions, religions that are not Christian in base, religions that are not do not believe that the Bible is God's word.
Have you noticed the same thing that I have, Dr. Nason? And in fact, I even heard an interview this weekend on the radio, a science program, where several teachers, academics, evolutionist theorists were being interviewed. And this sounded like a full court press. I mean, they were talking about, we got to get out there and essentially, not their word but mine, evangelize these schools again, right, and these teachers again, to get them back on track with evolution, lest
right,
we lose any ground.
Yes, and Eugenie Scott, who is heading up the National Science Education Standards, that's her very word. She says that she's an evangelist for evolution. Well, just by using that word, they're saying that it is a religious, it is a philosophical base. It has a philosophical base, and that's not science either. So, again, we need to realize that whatever you believe is how you perceive origins. It's not science.
So, it is just as much a metaphysical statement to say this universe is godless and driven by chance and the random interactions of matter as it is to say this universe is created by an intelligent designer.
Yes. In fact, I think that it may be easier to prove that God did it than it is to prove that evolution, they speak of evolution as if evolution is a God itself, that it caused the universe to be. Well, that's still something that caused the universe to be what it should be. And even though it's nothing, they claim it as something. So, and I hate to say they and us, because there are some Christians who do believe in evolution. I just don't think that they've read the Bible thoroughly enough to get to the point where they've been convicted. But science is what's at stake. And science is a freedom of thought and the freedom of being able to interpret the observable data the way you believe it should be interpreted. And you interpret it according to your worldview and what you believe. And if you are an evolutionist, you only look for things that would prove that it happened through evolution. And if you're a creationist or an intelligent design scientist, you will look for evidence for whatever it is you're trying to prove, because that is how you perceive things. That's the glasses you perceive things through. And that's a fact of science. It has been known all throughout scientific history, although the word science in the 1828 dictionary, Noah Webster's, doesn't even call science the study of nature. All fields, all subjects are considered sciences, and it's considered to be knowledge. So the word science is a fairly new word.
And this conception of science as something that deals only with natural things, only with what can be observed, only would of necessity then exclude any reference to a God, a creator, or a designer, that's a recent occurrence?
Yes, the interpretation that science, it is observable. It always has been something that's observable, but it's the interpretation of that observation that makes it a human endeavor that goes beyond just observation. Once we start interpreting what we see and trying to put a reason behind it, then we start using our own thoughts and our own worldviews.
Krautheimer seems to want to say that, look, God can have his realm, religion, and that's all fine and good. Just keep to religious subjects. And science can have its realm, and that's all fine and good. Keep to scientific subjects, but never the twain shall meet. Never the twain can meet. And yet he paints a picture at the end of his column, and I want your reaction to this, where he says, what would be more elegant, more simple, more brilliant, more economical, more creative, indeed more divine, than a planet with millions of distinct yet interactive life forms, ultimately derived from accumulated variations on a single double-stranded molecule, pliable and fecund enough to give us mollusks and mice, Newton and Einstein?
Yes, and add the rest of that statement. He's using the term a single double-stranded molecule, meaning that that's where it all began. And actually, he has it backwards. I think he does see that there, if he's not denying that there's a God, but if God's hand was in this and we try to explain it because of God, then it's wrong. And to me, it's wrong if we don't try to talk about God and all this, because it's beyond what we are. Our God is bigger than we are, and we can't ever understand him. And that's one of the problems, is he says that that Einstein, in the same article, saw his entire vocation as an attempt to understand the mind of God. Well, if we could understand the mind of God, we would be gods ourselves, and no one can understand the mind of God. And thank God. He plays with words, and he's good at it. But I think he's being very philosophical, and it shows where he stands, and that is for evolution and for a godless society.
Well, it seems as though he has a problem with Origins himself in his last paragraph, because he says, you know, it's all derived from this double-stranded molecule, pliable and fecund enough to give us mollusks and mice. Where did the double-stranded molecule come from?
Right, right.
I mean, that's a good beginning point, but that, unless, I mean, I would like to him to explain, take one more paragraph and explain where the DNA came from,
yes,
from which everything supposedly grew out of by variation.
Well, and of course, an evolutionist believes it was there by accident, and they just happened, these molecules just happened to get together. So it's really absurd when you think about the whole thing.
Let's talk about this in terms of its educational impact, because
yes,
that, of course, is the genesis of Krauthammer's concerns about both Kansas and Pennsylvania. What would it look like, ideally, if we were to have, and we've had guests on this program who say, look, ideally in the science classroom, we don't talk about origins.
Mm-hmm.
We talk science. We talk about what we can observe if we're going to teach science or biology. We deal with the science on the ground, and we do not teach origins to students. We let them draw their own conclusions. What do you think about that?
Well, they don't, basically, because they only give them one side, one idea. And in fact, when the stickers were taken off the textbook in books in Florida, the judge more or less said that we don't want the kids to be using higher level thinking, because then they'll think that it had to be God. And yet, on the other hand, that's the thing that the national standards, science education standards, push is higher level thinking, as long as they don't ask questions about evolution. And they say the biggest problem is that students do not believe in evolution. And so they are even saying that it is a belief system. And education is something that gives all sides, it gives all interpretations, and allows students, in science especially, you have to look at all angles, the null hypothesis. Anything that would disprove whatever it is you're trying to prove is also supposed to be considered. And that's what floors me, is they will not allow anything that disproves evolution or questions it to even be brought into the classroom. That is not freedom of speech, and it is not education. It is indoctrination.
Do you think that Kansas is a momentary aberration or the beginning of something of a trend in science education?
I hope that it is beginning to be a trend. In Ohio, you know that they actually, I'm not sure how far they have to go, but in that state they can teach both sides. At least they can teach the evidence against evolution. And they find that the kids are doing much better on their tests, because our students aren't dumb. They don't want to just memorize facts. They would rather learn from a controversy. And they would delve into what they're supposed to learn if there is a controversy there. If there are two sides given, they want to find out which side is they believe in or don't believe in. Or they'll look for the truth from both sides. And the fear is, I just see that evolutionists at this point are so afraid that if other theories get their foot in the door, it's going to really harm evolution. And instead, they, as scientists, they should be looking for other answers. And to me, they're not showing what a true scientist is.
You know, I don't know how often I have seen the Scopes monkey trial referred to in print about this thing. And it's always referred to as though, you know, when are these crazy creationists, intelligent design people going to realize we settled that back then, and this is settled science and no one can question it.
And actually, that trial was about an appeal for freedom of thought and discussion. It wasn't just about evolution. And they are using it wrongly, and they haven't read all the information about the Scopes trial, and it's scary to me because most people don't have that background. They don't know what really happened to the Scopes trial.
ICR.org is the website for the Institute for Creation Research, ICR.org. Dr. Patty Nason, thank you for being our guest.
Oh, it was a joy.
You're welcome. Dr. Nason is chairman of the Department of Science Education for the Institute for Creation Research. The website address again, icr.org. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll have Uwe Simonetto here in Studio A. We're going to begin a series with him on lay vocation. We'll begin with his vocation, which is journalist. Can a Christian be a journalist? Is journalism such a dirty business that Christians can't get their hands dirty in it? We'll talk about that in about 10 minutes. In the meantime, Pam Fichter is our guest. She joins us to talk about something else that was in the paper in the Metro section. Coalition's Ad Blitz Promotes Stem Cell Research. Former Senator Danforth, you may have seen his face on television, pushing for, what are they talking about? It's called Life-Saving Cures. Pam Fichter joins us, president of Missouri Right to Life, to talk about this advertising campaign. Pam, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Have you seen the commercials yet?
Oh, I have. I have indeed.
What is former Senator Danforth, who had a reputation of being pro-life, what's he doing, lending not only his face and his voice, but also a considerable amount of his reputation to this Life-Saving Cures campaign?
Well, quite sadly and very disappointingly, he is attempting to deceive the public. What this initiative that he is promoting will do will make it unconstitutional to protect cloned human embryos, and protect human embryos who have been created through IVF fertilization treatment. What this initiative will do, it will allow the biotech people to move ahead with their plan to clone and kill human beings. His ad is so outrageous because he is using his former label as being pro-life to promote something that is very, very anti-life. And it's deceptive, it's dishonest, it is just outrageous.
So far, the goal of this campaign seems to be, of course, getting signatures, somewhere near 150,000 signatures necessary to get an initiative on the ballot. Does it seem to be working?
Well, I mean, they have a tremendous amount of money to spend on this, and of course they're going to need it because it's very expensive to promote a lie. But what they hope to do is to block any legislation that would ban human cloning. And they're attempting to do it, to do this by deceptively promoting their initiative as a ban on cloning. But what this initiative will do will be to mandate the destruction of human embryos, and will, what it will prevent is the implantation and live birth of embryos. But it does not ban cloning. It just, it mandates the destruction of cloned human beings.
Okay, you talked about Danforth's statement about how he's pro-life and that's why he's for this, and kind of the deception at work there. Your reaction to this line from the longer ad, the 60-second spot,
mm-hmm.
that's also airing locally, and it's the announcer's voice saying some politicians in Jefferson City want to ban important types of stem cell research and cures in Missouri, and make life-saving stem cell research a crime in our state. Any cures that anyone's trying to ban?
This is just as deceptive, just as dishonest. and just as outrageous as the Danforth ad. What it does is it blurs the line. It doesn't mention that adult stem cells are research in adult stem cells, which are non-lethal. They do not destroy human life, are perfectly legal, perfectly ethical, and it's the only type of stem cell research that has shown any benefit. The embryonic stem cell research, which is what they want the freedom to do, destroys a human life and has never been successfully used in human application. It is so dangerous, even in research on animals, that it has never been approved for research in human beings. It is not responsible for one successful treatment nor one successful cure, where treatment using adult stem cells is responsible for close to 70, I believe it's up to now, successful treatments. Your listeners can go to www.stemcellresearch.org for an update on the advances in adult stem cell research and also the failures of embryonic stem cell research.
With only about a minute here, Pam, what is the most important issue that Missourians need to know about this ballot initiative that is being so much touted by this ad campaign?
Well, they need to know to oppose it. They need to know that they are being lied to. They need to know that they are, that their position to oppose human cloning is being manipulated dishonestly by this organization. And they need to not to sign the petition, and should it make the ballot, they need to vote against it. It is an initiative that would allow the cloning and killing of human beings.
Pam Fichter is a regular guest. She's president of Missouri Right to Life. The website for Missouri Right to Life, MissouriLife.org, MissouriLife.org. Pam, thank you for your time. I'm sure we'll be talking to you about this soon.
Thank you so much.
Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Uwe Simonetto. He'll be with us in Studio A for the remainder of the program till 5:45. We're going to be beginning a series on lay vocation, and we'll begin with his vocation, a journalist. You know, journalism is a tough business. Journalism is a necessary business. And Christians have, at least in the last 30 years or so, taken a very jaded view toward those who keep the record of our laws, our sayings, our activities, newspaper journalists, television journalists, radio journalists. Is this a fit vocation for a Christian? We'll talk about that and that vocation of journalist when we come back from this break. One thought on that initiative before we go to our break. You know, it's telling. It tells you a lot when an ad campaign doesn't use the term embryonic, when an ad campaign for embryonic stem cell research won't raise that issue, and when it must blur the distinction between the different kinds of stem cell research and the lethality of one and the promise of the other in order to make its case. That tells you something. If they could make the case without blurring the distinction, I think they would, but they can't. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.